Thanks to the organizers for putting this all together. I understand that there's a lot of different backgrounds in the room. So if I'm, you know, relying upon something that you don't know, then go ahead and interrupt me. And if it's something quick, then I will tell you what it is. And if it's not quick, then I will refer you to things later. So let me begin just by giving you a quick summary of what is we're going to be covering in the next 3 days. As you can see, the topics that we're covering are dark matter and dark matter theory. This is an extremely exciting time to be thinking about dark matter theory. It may turn out that all of the things that we're thinking about are totally, totally wrong, but what's exciting is that there's a lot of data out there which is making us reconceive what we had thought were our assumptions about what dark matter should be or what it should be like, what its natural features would be. So what I want to take you through over the course of the next 3 days is sort of what we know about dark matter, what we thought we knew about dark matter, and then what all of the things which are causing people to go crazy nowadays are, and the types of theories that people are working on to explain those. So the basic outline is going to be that today we'll do a summary of dark matter, just so that those of you who've not, you know, seen models and things like that are at least introduced to the different phrases and things that we think about. Tomorrow we'll go into specific models of dark matter. And the third day will be dark matter anomalies. I put that in quotes because, of course, these are really just signals which may have nothing to do with dark matter, but are at least possibly related to dark matter, and the types of new theories that are being motivated to think about those. So let's start there. So there's a slight irony in that I am giving some lectures about dark matter because, as it turns out, I know remarkably little about dark matter. But the thing that makes that OK is the thing that I want you to remember is that, as far as theories of dark matter goes, no one knows anything about dark matter. So that's not entirely true. We actually know a lot about dark matter. But when I say no one knows anything about dark matter, the thing to remember is that we have a set of models of dark matter that have certain properties. And so people will come and tell you, oh, this is something which is dark matter naturally does, or this is something dark matter doesn't naturally do. And that's all based upon our notions of what models that we've actually worked on. And as those models change and evolve, what we consider to be natural about dark matter changes significantly. And we've even seen it change a lot in the last year. So let's, just to give you a sense of this, think historically. If you asked somebody a long, long time ago, what are the properties of dark matter? So you went back, you know, 100 years, and you said, what are the properties of dark matter, meaning, you know, the matter in the universe which does not trace light, okay? Because there are, I think people would have been happy with the idea that there was dark matter. But I think that if you ask somebody, what are the properties of the matter which does not trace light, they would have said something to the effect of that its properties back then would have been none, because there was no such thing. So if natural dark matter properties 100 years ago would be nothing, right? Because there is no dark matter. I think then it would have evolved and people would have said, you know, so after there was enough evidence that dark matter should be there, probably the natural properties people would have said are maybe it's some sort of like missing gas at a temperature that we can't observe, or maybe it's, you know, macho, so you've got, you know, objects, unignited stars, things like this. So the natural properties of dark matter would have been something like this for a significant amount of time after that. Once people started understanding that neutrinos could have mass, I think that if you ask somebody what is the natural property of dark matter, you would have said, well, the natural property of dark matter would be the properties of neutrinos. And it's only once we started understanding structure formation that and our basic limits on neutrino mass that we understand that this is actually a lousy candidate for dark matter, so this is not what dark matter is. And if you ask somebody today, what is the natural property of dark matter, they probably would refer you to the property of neutralinos, which are in SUSY models. Okay, so if you say, what does a typical dark matter particle look like, they'll tell you that it looks like a neutralino, and that's this sort of defines what a natural property would be. And so you can either, as you think about what is natural for dark matter, you can either believe that we have somehow finally arrived at the point where we are uber wise and that our intuition about what dark matter is will no longer evolve, even though we have not actually discovered the dark matter, or you can just think of this as some sort of progress, something that's evolving. So I just think it's important to take with a grain of salt whenever anybody says, oh, dark matter wouldn't do that or dark matter would do that, because nobody really knows anything. Okay? So that's what nobody knows. So let's talk about what people do know. Before I get to what people do know, let me add some points just about how the field is evolving right now. The important thing about the field right now is that we are entering in something that people like to refer to as the era of data. There are a whole host of experiments that are going on. You've got, and I should also make sure I had Planck in here. You've got cosmic ray experiments like Pamela and Fermi, which are giving us, of course, very exciting data. You've got atmospheric Cherenkov telescopes like Milagro, Milagro's not, that's different, but like HESS or MAGIC. You've got direct detection experiments like CDMS and Xenon. And then, of course, you've got the LHC and Fermi lab. You've got Planck coming online. You've got a tremendous amount of data coming from a tremendous number of sources, which are all informing what you think dark matter could or couldn't be. So, and it's all happening sort of simultaneously. So we're arriving at this era of data, and this is changing our approach to dark matter theories in that before, I think that what you had was something like this, where you had theories of beyond the standard model physics, and that would then inform your theories of dark matter. And now you have your signals, and that's motivating your theories. And when I say signals of dark matter, I mean both the things that we're actually seeing right now, which could be related to dark matter or could not be, but also you can just look at all of these different experiments and say, what types of dark matter are they capable of finding? Because since you're going to have all this data, it makes a lot of sense to be focusing on those theories that connect to this era of data, which we're going through right now. So this is the way we used to think about dark matter. It was much more driven by trying to solve things like the hierarchy problem with supersymmetry or the strong CP problem, and then we would have our candidates come out of that. The newer candidates that people are talking about don't necessarily pop out of any given theory, but can often be embedded in those theories. But they're always, always, always nowadays connected to some interesting signal which you're going to see at one of these experiments. So, any questions? That's just my spiel to start. So, let's begin with our evidence for dark matter. It's very important as we think about dark matter that although it's true that you should not be too biased by the types of theories that actually already exist, there are a lot of constraints on dark matter. And dark matter is, at this point, not just a kludge. It's not just a parameter you put into your theory. It is, in fact, a well-defined theory of cosmology, having the dark matter component there. It's a fairly uninteresting theory, in some sense, in that it's just cold, collisionless matter. But it does make predictions, and those predictions have been borne out again and again with just a couple of possible minor exceptions. So let me run through what they are. You have, of course, the original evidence from Zwicky, observations of clusters. And in a cluster of galaxies, and I won't tell you too much about this because I believe that we'll be hearing a great deal about this later today by somebody who knows so much that I would embarrass myself if I start talking about it. But the fact that you have galaxies in a cluster gives you, by studying the motions of those galaxies, allows you to get a measurement of the amount of mass there. And looking at clusters gives you an indication there must be a lot of additional mass there. So that's one piece of evidence. If you ask somebody on the street, if you just go up to a random person in Waterloo and you say, what do you think the evidence for dark matter is? A typical person will probably say, well, it's rotation curves of galaxies. That's pretty reasonable. And the idea there is that if you have a spiral galaxy, okay, and then you look at objects that are moving farther and farther away, these are usually, you're using like radio observations to make these measurements. As you move farther and farther away from the center of the galaxy, if all of the matter is located in the middle here, then just because you're getting farther away from the matter, you would expect that there's a weaker force. And so if you look at as a function of radius away from the center of the galaxy, and you ask how fast are these objects moving, you expect that the farther out ones should be moving more slowly than the inside one. So this should be moving faster than that, that should be moving faster than that, and so on, right? But what you actually find when you do this is, at least to a fairly long range out, the rotation curve is flat. So this thing is moving as fast as that, is moving as fast as that. And since we all know from our studies of Poisson's equation that if it's a spherical distribution of matter, you are determined simply by the amount of matter in here, that means that there must be a lot of matter here, there must be a lot of matter here. So there must be matter outside of this sphere, and a matter outside of this sphere, a matter outside of that sphere, in order to keep pulling the farther and farther objects in their rotation. You just heard a whole lot about lensing, so I won't tell you about lensing, but lensing gives you independent evidence for dark matter. A particular example of this that people like to point at is the Bullitt cluster. I'm not going to really talk about that, but the Bullitt cluster is a very interesting example of giving you a situation where dark matter and baryonic matter seem to have actually separated from one another. Then you have things like power spectra. You've got power spectra both of galaxies from structure formation as well as the CMB. So everybody knows this plot, right? But you also have the power spectra of correlation functions of various galaxies. So I'm trying to copy this from a WMAP paper. This is a gigaparsec here, and this is about a megaparsec here. And so you've got things like the CMB, which probes some, so this is the power spectrum of the galaxies of the two-point functions. The CMB will probe some region of distance scales. So you've got very large distances are probed by the CMB. You've got things like the two-degree field survey or SDSS or other galaxy surveys that can study the distribution of galaxies on the sky. And then at very small scales, you've got Lyman alpha. In the future, you might have 21 centimeter measurements. But the point is that if the reason why these things become sensitive to dark matter is twofold. Dark matter, baryonic matter, is tightly coupled to the photon baryon fluid. Ordinary matter is, because it's got protons and electrons, and those carry charge. And so if you have an overdensity of photons, then that pushes around with it the overdensity of baryons. So it's very hard for an overdensity of baryons to grow in the early universe while the universe is charged before recombination. So dark ordinary matter tries to fall into a gravitational potential, but it can't because it gets pushed back out by the pressure. Dark matter, on the other hand, can fall into a pressure, into a potential well in the early universe, and so you can build up larger and larger perturbations from dark matter in the early universe, whereas baryons you have to wait until after recombination. So that kind of effect has an effect both on what the relative, I mean, it has effect on the relative heights of these peaks because dark matter falls in and baryonic matter gets pushed out, and on the overall normalization of this power spectrum. So dark matter makes predictions for how large the fluctuations of delta rho over rho should be, so by delta power spectra, I mean delta rho over rho, on a wide range of scales, and so far it's been very successful. It's very nonlinear down here, and I don't want to say anything about that. Lastly, you have Big Bang nucleosynthesis. So Big Bang nucleosynthesis is the fact that you successfully predict light element abundances to a fairly good degree, in some cases an extremely good degree, and to get the right amount of light element abundances from your cosmology means that you have to have a baryon to photon ratio of so that if you want to have the right amount of lithium, helium, and deuterium that we observe, then helium-3, then you need to have a baryon to photon ratio of about 6 × 10⁻⁹. We know how many photons there are because we can just measure the CMB, and then we can invert that to tell us that the total amount of baryons out there must be about 4% of the energy density of the universe. So that's a lightning review, I know, and I'm mainly just putting it up there because I think it's important that you just sort of see the set of things that people talk about. I don't expect you to completely follow all of these things, but the point is that you have a number of different observations from a number of different sources which are really testing different properties, right? This tests something very different from this. Lensing tests something very different from rotation curves, from which is different from clusters. So dark matter is being approached from many, many, many sources, and they're all pointing you to the fact that there should be dark matter and basically the same amount of dark matter. So it really is a theory that's made predictions on a lot of different distance scales. And so I do this so that hopefully I can stop as many of you from running off and working on MOND before you have tenure. Because really, the evidence is very good, and it works very, very well. So it's not just something we add into the theory. It's really a theory now, and it works very well. Yes?
How much darker influences the part of the Big Bang nucleosynthesis? Because there's no... can I remove it or put a lot of it, and then you still need only the ratio of baryons and photons to get out?
Well, you need the ratio of... baryons to photons to be correct, and you need the Hubble rate to be correct. And you need the relationship between the current Hubble rate and the Hubble rate at temperature of 1 MeV to be given by what you think it should be in a standard cosmology. So you do still need to have a significant additional matter component.
Okay.
But that's for kind of.
Yeah? If I have a more dark matter, how
will
the
pattern change?
The shape?
It depends on what you hold constant and what you fix. But basically, as you add more and less dark matter, what you start doing is changing the relative heights of these peaks just because of it's telling you about how much stuff is falling in, how much stuff is falling
out. Fast speed doesn't change.
Should be?
Fast speed doesn't change.
That then again depends on what you're holding constant, right? Because if you start just adding dark matter and, like, say, taking away dark energy, then you'll start changing the age of the universe, and that will move the first peak. Good. So there's a lot of evidence for dark matter. So if you want to build a theory of dark matter, what are your constraints? What do you have to worry about? Well, so what do we know? So that's the evidence for dark matter. What do we actually know about dark matter? Basically, we know that this cold dark matter description is a good description, but we know a few other things. So the zero thing that we know is that dark matter is massive. So the equation of state parameter is approximately equal to zero. So that is to say that the energy density in dark matter is scales like the scale factor to the -3, right? So as the universe expands, the energy density of dark matter dilutes like volume, okay? This is important because if you start adding a lot of funny interactions to dark matter, like allowing its mass to evolve cosmologically, you very often will get equations of state which are not zero, And so this can be an important limitation. But the point is, at least in leading order, dark matter should act like matter. The second thing is that dark matter should be neutral. One reason for this, a very basic thing, is that if you have dark matter which is lighter than half the Z boson mass, then the Z boson can decay into dark matter. So if it carries a significant SU2 cross U1 charge, so if it has some, you know, if it has coupling to the Z boson, basically, which most things which carry, like, for instance, electric charge or, well, the carrying SU2 charge would do, then we would have seen it at left, in the sense that we've measured the width of the Z boson, we know how much the invisible width is, there's not any additional, it's accounted for entirely by neutrinos, so the entire decay of Z into nu accounts for all of the invisible width of the Z, so there can't be a decay of the Z into dark matter, so it should not couple, if it's going to couple the Z bosons, it should be heavier than half the mass of the Z. The second, so still along this line of it being neutral, is that you could imagine that you have, you could ask, well, could dark matter just fundamentally be charged, right? So could dark matter be charged? And the answer is no, not really. So there's limiting to that. For instance, suppose that it has an integer charge, like charge plus or minus 1. Then you have heavy hydrogen surges. So you can go deep and get water from the bottom of the sea, and if dark matter had a charge plus 1, then it would bind with an electron and form something that would look just like, hydrogen. Right, except for that instead of having a mass of one proton, it would have a mass of whatever the dark matter is. So you can go take deep seawater, filter through it, and see if you have any water that weighs a lot. Studies from this, I'm just picking a particular mass range here. So for dark matter between five times the mass of the proton to 1,600 times the mass of the proton, that's limited to be the abundance of dark matter has to be less than 4 × 10⁻¹⁷. So basically it's not there. So you can't have a charged dark matter, because charged dark matter, even if somehow managed to hide itself, we would find it on Earth in heavy hydrogen surges. And for different ranges of masses, you get different limits here. Even if dark matter, you could imagine a situation where dark matter has a charge which is epsilon, okay? So instead of having a charge of plus or minus 1, you could imagine you have millicharged particles. Now, there's not an obvious reason why you want to do that, but it's important that you know all these limits. And the plot that you committed to memory, it shows you why you can't have that. There are a number of different constraints on this. Some of them are from, if you have millicharged dark matter, that can still affect the evolution of the early universe. For instance, if in some ranges it can be tightly coupled, just like baryons. So over a wide range of masses and charges, it'll still couple to the photon-baryon fluid, and you won't get the appropriate power spectrum. You also have accelerator surges. You could make this stuff, and it hasn't been found, so there are some fairly good constraints on that as well. So obviously, if you make your dark matter, 10⁻⁹ charge, then that's close enough to zero that you can consider it neutral. But in some sort of like range of like 0.01 or around there, it's fairly constrained in the weak scale. So we know that it's massive, we know that it's neutral, and lastly, at zeroth order, we know that it's not proton, neutron, electron, partially because of these reasons, partially because BBN tells us that it's not proton, neutron, partly because CMB tells us that it's not proton, neutron. So the important thing is that dark matter has these properties. It's massive, neutral, and something different. Okay? That's what you are aiming for. These are all zero-order things. Are there any questions about the zero-order things? I promise that I will slow down when we get to things which are more complicated.
I have a quick question.
Yes.
Is there evidence that it doesn't have a additional structure?
Like compositeness.
Right.
Sort of. So if you have an object which is composite, usually that particle will have a cross-section, an effective size, right, which is set by the compositeness scale, right? Like an atom has a cross-section which is, you know, comparable to an angstrom because that's how big an atom is. So if dark matter is sufficiently large that it has a large cross-section like that, then there are constraints on that. So there are constraints on the interactions that could arise from composites. So you want it to be small enough that those interactions are small enough to satisfy the constraints that I'll describe in 1 second. But that dark matter could be for instance, if you imagine that the particle was, say, a 100 GeV particle which had a compositeness scale of a GeV, so it looked something like a hadron, right, just something, but not an actual hadron, but something that looked like a hadron, that would be fine, right? So if it had mesonics, if it were like a, you don't think meson, if it were baryon that had some sort of, you know, various excited state, things like that would be fine. I think a GeV would probably be fine. The cross section would be smaller.
Neil.
Yes.
Just 0A. I worry that you're ruling out axions right from the get-go.
I'm not ruling out axions from the get-go. I'll get to axions.
Okay.
Because axions have W of 0, right?
Right, but they've got masses that are tiny.
But massive, just when I say massive, all I mean is that it behaves like this.
Okay.
Right? Yeah. So I promise that I'll come to axions and not rule them out.
Okay.
And not imply that they're ruled out. Axions are not ruled out. I'll say that definitively right now. All right, so, yeah, we'll come to that. So, what are the other things that we know?
One thing is that dark matter should be cold. What does that mean? Because people will say that it's cold, and they usually mean one thing, but what we actually know from data is another thing. When people say that dark matter is cold, what they usually mean is that when dark matter was produced, whenever that was, it was non-relativistic. Okay? So that it did not have a significant kinetic energy. What we actually know is that when the temperature, I should say this because I forgot this, is that I will be using temperature interchangeably with time, right? Because the universe presently, the temperature of the universe is about 10 to the minus 4 eV. And as you go back in time, the universe gets hotter and hotter and hotter. Okay? So there are different eras of the universe which can be referred to by their temperature. This is the present temperature. The temperature of BBN is about 1 MeV. Okay, so I'll often say, like, at temperatures of, and what I mean is at the time in the universe when the temperature was. So that's just a shorthand. So when the temperature of the universe was, you know, of the order of 10 keV or so, that's really what you need for the dark matter to have been cold. Because what happens, if dark matter is relativistic, then it can freely stream, okay? So if I have a particle which is relativistic and I have an overdensity of that particle, then it can just fly out of that overdensity and I can smooth out any inhomogeneities that I see. And when I go over and I look at the power spectrum that I observe, those power spectra are consistent with there being a primordially scale invariant spectrum on all scales down to whatever we can see. So basically, what you want to make sure is that the dark matter was non-relativistic at such a point in the history of the universe that it could not have screwed up that observation. So if dark matter started relativistic, but then cooled off at some point in its history, then maybe it will kill all of the power at small scales, but it will leave the power at large scales because it'll free stream until such point in the universe that it stops free streaming because it'll cool down as the universe expands. So what you really need is that dark matter was cold by 10 keV or so. In reality, most dark matter particles start out cold, but what you really need is that dark matter was cold by 10 keV, maybe 100 keV, depending on what you think about Lyman alpha emission. Because this is just an aside, but for instance, people always talk about neutrinos as hot dark matter, but neutrinos are themselves right now cold. If you started with a neutrino which had
a mass which has a mass of one electron volt, for instance, when it's produced, it's relativistic. But that one eV neutrino actually became non-relativistic at a redshift of something like 10,000. Okay, so even things that we talk about as hot dark matter candidates are today cold. So I just want to do that, point that out, because people throw around this term of cold and things better be cold and so on, and it's important just to be clear what we're talking about. But dark matter better be cold, because if it's not cold, then it can destroy structure, it can smooth out the inhomogeneities. We see inhomogeneities, therefore they were not smoothed out, therefore dark matter was not hot. Good. What else do we know about dark matter? We know that dark matter is essentially non-interacting. Okay, this comes to your question about compositeness. What does that mean to say that dark matter is non-interacting? What that really means is that to the extent that we've studied dark matter with a non-interacting fluid and it seems to describe things well, that we would like to preserve those successes. So what you really kind of insist upon is that dark matter should have scattered, so had a scattering less than about one time in the age of the universe. So you can do a quick estimate of that. You can say, well, let's think about what cross-section that implies for dark matter in our galaxy. So this is a very simple calculation, right? So there's some number density of dark matter in the galaxy. You assume the dark matter has some cross-section, and you assume that it's moving with some velocity, okay? So this is the rate. And then we just multiply the rate times the total age of the universe to get the total number of scatters. So we want this number to be less than about 1. Okay? So if you plug in the age of the universe here, and you plug in a velocity, you plug in a velocity of like 10 to the minus 3 times the speed of light, which is roughly what particles move at in our galaxy. And you take the density of 0.3 GeV per cubic centimeter. You'll see people throw that around a lot, which is, divided by the mass of the dark matter. So these are all very conventional numbers. Then you find that the cross-section had better be something like 10 to the minus 24 centimeters squared for a dark matter particle, which weighs 1 TeV. This is an enormous cross-section, right? This is a huge cross-section. We're talking nuclear scattering size cross-sections. So a particle with weak interactions will be totally fine. But a particle with very strong interactions would have scattered once in its history. And once particles start scattering, they can transfer energy throughout the halo, and the halo can begin to collect. So this is but that's the only constraint you have on its interactions, really. It's totally fine to add interactions to dark matter. You just can't add very, very strong interactions to dark matter. We also know that dark matter, basically, the only long-range force that dark matter has is gravity. If dark matter had a different long-range force than just gravity, so let's suppose that it coupled to some new force that, you know, interacted over, you know, many kiloparsec distance scales, then the dwarf galaxies in the halo would be tidally disrupted in a way which is different from what you would have expected normally. So you can place a limit on the coupling, which is called beta, which is the strength of the new force relative to gravity, so for that's for an effectively infinite range force. Yes, there's a question. That's dark matter scattering off of itself. Right. Yeah. We'll come to a discussion about the limits on dark matter scattering off of ordinary matter shortly. There are much stronger limits on dark matter scattering off of ordinary matter. So that's pretty much it. If you have a particle which is stable, at least it's stable, its lifetime is longer than the age of the universe. And if it's non-interacting subject to these constraints that I provided for you here, if it's neutral, so that depending on its mass, its charge is at least less than 10 to the minus 2 or 10 to the minus 3, and it has the appropriate relic abundance, then you have for yourself a good theory of dark matter. Okay? So this is basically all you need to do. And then your dark matter will be fine. Oh, and I should say, cool, as we've described. Questions about this? Excuse me?
I think the particle is not code, is it right?
It's
not code.
Which at 10 keV,
yeah.
You think that it should be cold earlier than that?
I mean, axion particle. Axion.
Axion. Oh, sorry, the axion particle. The axion particle would not have a mass of 10 keV. Its mass is 10 to the minus 6 electron volts. So what I mean when I say that it should be cold at 10 keV, I mean that if you go back in time, it's fine if the dark matter particle was moving relativistically when temperatures were an MeV. Okay? So if you go back to an MeV temperature or a GeV temperature, and the dark matter is moving relativistically fine, as long as by the time, but as the universe expands, that particle is losing energy. It's cooling off because its wavelength is being stretched out. And so once you get, eventually that particle should become non-relativistic. And I'm saying that when it goes through that transition occurs, that transition better happen no later than about a temperature of 10 keV. But an axion starts out cold, so an axion is fine. We'll come to axions. We'll come to axions very, very shortly. A lot of axions here. good. So, since today is basically today, right? This is just a lightning review of everything that you should just have down on paper so you know these are things that people say when they talk about dark matter. So what about models of dark matter? So let me take you through this. So we're talking about particles that have these things here. It actually is on the top of my list. You have the axion. So the axion is motivated by the strong CP problem. So why do the strong interactions conserve CP while the weak interactions violate CP? And it's a scalar particle, and the idea is that you add it, you have a theta parameter in your Lagrangian. And if that theta parameter is there in your Lagrangian, coupling to your gluon field strength, GG dual, this induces CP violation that would have been observed in experiments like neutron electric dipole moments and things like that. So you add in this particle, the axion, okay, and that particle, the axion, will develop a potential automatically where the axion will shift. So the axion will go to negative theta plus a tilde in the low energy at the end of the day. So it will cancel off this theta. And so your CP violating term goes away. So the axion shifts to cancel off the theta term, and then the axion becomes a dark matter candidate. I'll go through that a bit better in a second. You have the neutralino. The neutralino, which is motivated by the hierarchy problem. So why is the Higgs boson as light as it must be? Why is it not the Planck scalar mass? for those of you who haven't studied supersymmetry, in supersymmetry, every time you have a particle, you have a superpartner. Okay, so the quark has the swart partner, the gluon has the gluino. And so in the standard model, you know that the neutral particles that you have are, for instance, the B hypercharge gauge boson. You have the neutral component of the W, which is neutral. And then you have the Higgs boson, which is neutral. And then in supersymmetry, it turns out that there's a second Higgs boson, Higgs up and Higgs down. And then you just put twiddles on all of these, and now it's supersymmetric. And so you have four fields in your theory, four fermionic fields in your theory, all of which are neutral. And these are defined by a particular basis, right? I define these in a basis where I'm connecting this to a gauge field, that to a gauge field, this to a gauge field, this to a gauge field. But I can take any linear combination of these things and it will still be a neutral particle. So there's some linear combination of these things. And that linear combination is the neutralino. There are four neutralinos. And the lightest neutralino is then the dark matter candidate. So the point is that people will often talk about a beano, which is the superpartner of this hypercharged gauge boson. But in general, the neutralino is an arbitrary linear combination of many different fields. Yes?
You say arbitrary, doesn't it have to be a mass eigenstate or something?
Yeah. It has to be it's a mass eigenstate, but there's, I'm just saying that a priori, there's nothing that tells me what these different alphas are. So it could be something which is more Beano-like, or it could be more Weino-like, or it could be more Higgsino-like. So I'll come back to that when I cover the SUSY dark matter, which will be tomorrow. So, good. Then you have, generally speaking, you have the L-pop, the lightest T-odd particle. This happens in little Higgs models. It's just the lightest particle that happens to be there. So it's also motivated by the hierarchy problem. You have Kaluza-Klein dark matter. So you can assume that there are additional dimensions with masses of, with radiuses which are like inverse TeV in size. It's not really motivated by the hierarchy problem. It's more motivated by the weak scale in the sense that KK dark matter doesn't really solve any problems for you. But you know the weak scale is interesting, so there could be dimensions of the weak scale, and maybe they have KK dark matter. Then you have the axino. The axino is the superpartner of the axion. So this is taking the best of both worlds. You're both supersymmetric and you're solving the strong CP problem. That's motivated by the hierarchy problem and the strong CP problem. Then you have fourth generation neutrinos. So a very, not a hot dark matter, but a heavy cold dark matter candidate. That's motivated by the first three generations. You have the gravitino, the superpartner of the graviton. This gravitino is motivated by the hierarchy problem and an unpleasant childhood. Because really, the gravitino, you can't find it. It doesn't interact with anything. If the gravitino is dark matter, then you really feel like then you must have feel guilty about something. Because you don't deserve it, and you must feel like I don't deserve to find the dark matter, because you won't find it. In general, any light, new, stable, weak scale particle, so anything at the TeV scale, is a good candidate. And then there's all sorts of other candidates. Microscopic black holes, things called Q-balls, various topological defects, but those are usually more particular, so I'm not going to go into them. Questions? This is just a list of the names that people will throw around. They're all dark matter candidates. Everybody loves their...
Is there a constraint? Is there a constraint of force emerging on neutrinos?
Yeah, there are. I mean, there are a lot of different types of constraints, and it depends on what you mean by a fourth generation neutrino. So I'll take that tomorrow as my canonical model of what is a sort of WIMP, and we'll work through it a bit then. So let me come to that then. There are constraints. There are definitely constraints. So how do you form dark matter? Right. So one of the big points of this of dark matter is that you want it to somehow naturally give you the right relic abundance. So in forming dark matter, you have sort of two ways. You have thermal, which is to say that the dark matter in the early universe is in equilibrium, okay?
Equilibrium.
So you have standard model particles, which can annihilate into dark matter particles, and dark matter particles can convert back into standard model particles at a rate which is high enough that the whole system reaches equilibrium. That would be a thermal dark matter candidate. And then you have, not surprisingly, non-thermal dark matter candidates. But there's a lot of different ways that you can have a non-thermal dark matter candidate. There's not just, while I think that there's sort of like one canonical way to have a thermal particle, there are a lot of different ways to have non-thermal particles. You could have the decay of another particle. Okay, for instance, the LSP decaying into a gravitino would be an example of non-thermal production. So the gravitino was never in thermal equilibrium. The lightest supersymmetric particle, the neutralino, say, was in thermal equilibrium in the early universe. It determined its relic density that way, then it decays into the gravitino. So that's non-thermal production. You could have it occur through a phase transition. That can happen in a lot of different ways. You could just have solitons that occur with some abundance when you have a phase transition. Or you could have a field like in inflation, right? In inflation, you have a field which is slowly rolling and converts from something which is dark energy-like to something which is dark matter-like. That would be one way that you could have non-thermal production. And then you can have incomplete N sigma B. So what I mean by that is that your dark matter particle maybe can convert back and forth between, like maybe it's possible to do this transition, but it never gets to the rate such that it really achieves an equilibrium situation. That could, for instance, happen if the universe never is very, very hot. If the universe never gets to a temperature like much heavier than the mass of your particle, it may never come into thermal equilibrium. And so you could, even though you can make it somewhat, so you can have standard model produce dark matter, it's not doing it effectively enough to really bring it to thermal equilibrium. And examples of this would be like Wino's, in some ranges of parameter space, actinos, and in some ranges of parameter space, gravitinos. So there are a lot of different ways that you can form dark matter non-thermally. Let me talk about one of them. Questions about this? Yes?
I have a question for the model of dark matter. Is that possible that the cosmic string loop becomes the dark matter?
I'm not an expert on cosmic string loops. I don't know. Usually people talk about cosmic strings in terms of the constraints that they have. But if it's just basically to the extent that the thing that you're talking about satisfies these conditions, it's a fine dark matter candidate. To the extent that it does not satisfy these conditions, then it's not a fine dark matter candidate. So depending on the size of that string loop would determine whether or not this was the size and mass would determine whether or not it was a reasonable particle. So
loops are not stable, are they?
Huh?
String loops are not stable.
Maybe if you added some sort of like additional topological twist to it or something like that, so it couldn't actually close on itself. But yeah, in general, it's true. They would just close and then make gravitational waves. Or whatever. But yeah. See, I said I don't know anything about loops. Okay, so let's just start with a very, very simple example of dark matter, a non-thermal example. And that would be a scalar field. This is sort of your canonical example of an axion, although I'm not going to make an axion right now for the sake of time.
A scalar field obeys the Klein-Gordon equation. So this is the Klein-Gordon equation. The only difference is that now you have this drag term, right, in your equation, which comes from the Hubble expansion. So you'd like your field to just oscillate back and forth, but you've got Hubble expansion, which is going to slow that down. So the easiest way to do this, right, we all know how to solve a differential equation like this, right? It's some sort of harmonic oscillator. So you take, did I do this with a real, I did this real. Take e to the I omega, or e to the omega t, and plug it into this equation, and you get this is, you know, it's a quadratic equation. Anybody here can solve this, right? So there are basically the first limit that you probably want to take is take the limit where
Are you taking h to be constant?
Huh? Oh, yes, I'm taking h to be constant. I am taking h to be constant, but everything that we'll do will carry over trivially, right? So let's begin by taking m much, much larger than h, okay? So that is the frequency of oscillation is much faster than the Hubble time. So this particle will oscillate many times before the universe expands significantly in size. If that's true, then I have a very simple solution here. I just have w is equal to minus 3h over 2 plus or minus im, right? So what does that kind of a particle look like? Well, if phi then is phi naught e to the minus 3h over 2t times e to the I mt, say, let me just take the positive solution for the moment, then let me ask a very simple question. What does the energy density of this phi look like? The energy density of this phi is phi dot squared over 2 plus m squared over 2 phi squared, where phi here is phi phi star because it's a complex field. So let me plug that into this expression, and what do I get? Well, since this is phi phi star, the e to the I mt drops out, and I just get phi naught squared times e to the minus 3h t over 2 plus, again, m squared, plus m squared over 2 phi naught squared e to the minus 3h t.
Sorry, you probably mean the frequency is minus 3h over 2 I plus or minus m?
I made it real. So this just tells me that the energy density is phi naught squared m squared e to the minus 3h t. But as Justin pointed out, I'm assuming that the Hubble constant is constant here, just for convenience. If h is constant, then I know that the scale factor is just e to the ht. Right? This is how the universe expands as De Sitter space. So rho is just rho naught, whatever it was at time equal to 0, times a to the minus 3. So what we very, very quickly find, just by doing this, is that if I start with a field which is oscillating, just a scalar field which is oscillating, and the frequency of its oscillation is much faster than the Hubble time, then it dilutes like volume. But this was our requirement, right? Is that we wanted it to be, I've erased it, no, massive. We wanted dark matter to dilute like volume. So a coherently oscillating scalar field dilutes like volume. So it doesn't. It's not what you think of as a particle, right? Because I haven't, like, you put a whole bunch of particles into the universe. I've just started with a field at some point up here and let it go, and it oscillates back and forth, and those oscillations damp off, and they damp off precisely in the way that it behaves like dark matter.
Questions about that? So, what about the other solution? The other solution, where I take the Hubble rate to be much, much larger than the frequency of oscillation. If I take H to be much larger than that, then I have a solution W, so this is H much, much, much larger than M. Then I have a solution to this equation, W is equal to minus 3H, and W is equal to minus 2M squared over 3H. Okay. So what's important about this is that if I plug this in, right, this term, m squared phi squared, will now be m squared phi naught squared. And the first term, e to the minus 3ht squared, will dilute incredibly fast. It will dilute like k to the minus 6. So anything which has this first, any amount of energy density which is in this first form will just vanish pretty instantly in the universe. Stuff in the second, anything which is in the second solution, will dilute like e to the minus 4m squared over 3ht. Okay? So the energy density will dilute like this. But remember, m is much, much less than h. So this number is very, very small, which means that if this number is very small, as long as we're talking about times which are much smaller than this, then this field will be essentially constant. Okay? So this is what you would consider to be the slow roll period for the scalar field. And then this would be the coherently oscillating period. So this is a generic property of any scalar field. If you start with that scalar field just out, sitting somewhere out on its potential, so I start with it like here, then it's just going to sit there because this term is so small. It'll basically sit there until the universe expands enough that the Hubble time is comparable to the mass, and then it'll transition from sitting here into coherently oscillating, and then you get this oscillation, and it decays away. So scalar field dark matter of this sort, non-thermal scalar field dark matter, always obeys this kind of basic cosmology. It sits there, it's frozen, it doesn't move for a long time in the universe. Then eventually, the Hubble constant gets lower and lower and lower and lower. Eventually, the Hubble constant gets sufficiently small that the Hubble constant is less than the mass, and then it begins coherently oscillating, and it converts from being something which looks like dark energy to looking like something that looks like dark matter. And this is the, you know, this is the sort of like paradigm for inflation also. What time did I start? Great. I just want to take 5 more minutes to say one thing about these types of scalar fields. Because you might think, well, look, this is great. This is a great model of dark matter, just some random scalar field that sits there and then it, you know, begins to oscillate. That seems like a good model. But this model, this kind of setup, actually has a generic problem which, loosely speaking, falls into the category of some classes of things people will refer to as the moduli problem or the Polonyi problem. And so let me just show you what that is very, 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 very quickly. So if you have a particle like this, then the natural assumption is that the initial value, right, if I say, what is, if I start, if here's 0, right, then where does this field start? How big is phi naught? Where does it initially begin? The natural place for phi naught to begin in any sort of reasonable theory would be with an expectation of M Planck. If M Planck is the only scale in your theory, if you start at incredibly high temperatures in a universe which is all M Planck, then everything should have values of M Planck. You can argue about this, but let me just take you through this argument. If you assume that you start with the value phi naught, which is M Planck, then what happens? Well, we want to ask what happens when M is equal to H. Okay? Because M equal to H is when this field will convert from being dark energy, from just sitting there, to being dark matter, to being a coherently oscillating field. Well, in the FRW cosmology, you know that the Hubble constant is basically given by the energy density of the universe divided by M Planck squared. But the energy density here in this scalar field is roughly equal to M squared by naught squared. That's how much energy it starts with. And that is then M squared M Planck squared. But we said that H squared was equal to, we said that H was equal to M. So that means that the energy density of the universe is approximately equal to M squared M Planck squared as well. So the universe is cruising along, minding its own business, getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and diluting its energy density. And then eventually the Hubble constant gets low enough that this field can start coherently oscillating. But at that moment when this field begins coherently oscillating, the energy density in this scalar field is roughly equal to the total energy density in the entire universe. That means that as soon as this field begins coherently oscillating, the universe is matter dominated. Okay? Because the amount of energy here is the same as the amount of energy in the entire universe. So if you wanted this to be a theory of dark matter, to explain dark matter by just some random scalar field that converts into a coherently oscillating system, then that would tell you that basically the dark matter only turned into dark matter at matter radiation equality. And matter radiation equality, because as soon as this starts oscillating, the universe is matter dominated. So matter radiation equality was at Z of like 3,000, which means that this did not act like cold dark matter before Z of 3,000, and we know that it better have been cold dark matter before that. So this is a very, very bad model, because it doesn't actually start acting like dark matter until very, very late times. Then there are a whole bunch of other problems with this. So I know that's a very, very, very lightning review. We'll go more slowly, I promise, tomorrow. But this is sort of the this is the setup. Now you know basically what you need to worry about if you want to have a model of dark matter. And this is sort of your starting canonical model. Tomorrow what we're going to do is we're going to go through thermal models of dark matter, things like neutralinos and things like that, and how to actually find them and detect them. And for that, we'll take our time. Okay, great, thanks.